Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to the programme. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service and we're coming to you live from London. My name's Paul Henley. In a moment, with just hours to go until the US presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, we'll hear from the key swing state of Pennsylvania. That's our main story this evening. Also on the programme, a SpaceX rocket has blasted off from Florida. It's crewed by non-professional astronauts. What are they trying to achieve while they're in space?
There are so many new things that they're doing on this mission. For instance, they're going three times the altitude of the space station, and that hasn't happened since we went to the moon. They're going to do the very first commercial spacewalk, which is extremely risky. There'll be in new spacesuits for the spacewalk. This is a mission that has a lot of added risk to it.
We also have the second of our reports from inside Afghanistan on how life has changed for millions of women under Taliban rule. Now, the first and potentially the only televised US presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump takes place tonight, US time. It's happening in the city of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, one of those swing states to which both candidates have been making repeated visits. On this programme, we're going to be hearing in detail from one of those crucial people, the undecided voters. We'll hear, too, about the role of Generation Z, and we'll have an overview from a political reporter on the difference this TV encounter might make to the whole competition. First, here's a report from the BBC's Tom Bateman, who's been meeting voters in western Pennsylvania.
The coal train to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, once stopped here and helped fuel the growth of a superpower. From the vast steel mills here, they built modern America. But now most of the factories are rusting hulks that litter the riverside. And for many folks here, they still survive, but among the last of the left behind.
Well, I know that's 11-inch. I worked in there. That was, at the time, the most modern mill they had.
You were building America. You were building a whole country.
Kept, it just kept rolling off there.
Yeah, that steel would come off of there about 80 miles per hour. It would roll into corals like that. It was a fast mill, fastest mill in the area.
Jack and Wayne, men of steel. They worked here for years, and then the layoffs came.
It's just a shame that it went this way here. I mean, Johnstown, when things were going good, when I was working, there was 12,000 people worked here. Bethlehem Steel was 12 miles long. Imagine 12 miles long from down in the end there.
Provided all the work.
Yeah, you thought you were going to be there till you retired, you know.
What do you think the answer to all this is now? Because you've got both Harris and Trump saying they want to reindustrialize, they want to bring back steel jobs, you know, they want to reinvest in the Rust Belt. Do you believe them?
I would believe Donald Trump. I don't believe Harris. She's been there 3.5 years and has done nothing. Now all of a sudden she's going to do something.
So I can tell which way you're going to vote.
Right, here's the hat, buddy.
Bit of a clue.
Yeah, I'm 100%. If it's an honest election, he'll win.
But I'm interested in what you say, because he had 4 years. He had 4 years he could have brought back.
We were energy independent when he was in there.
But we're still looking at this landscape where jobs have gone for years.
This was this way.
But nothing changed in his presidency then, so I'm just interested in why.
Yeah, I agree with you as far as this here, yeah.
But there's a lot of presidents around him and before him that nothing's changed. I mean, this didn't happen overnight.
The election trail has been surging through Pennsylvania. It is now an intense focus of both campaigns. But just as this state's political split is between urban and rural, it is also unequally divided among men and women.
Thanks.
On their porch, from where they've watched Johnstown transform, I meet Kelly and Joseph. Joseph was wounded fighting in Afghanistan, and Kelly demands more help for veterans. But there's an area they don't agree on, where Donald Trump's record has become a vulnerability for him, especially among women.
And as far as that abortion thing, that's a woman's right. That is not up to the government to decide.
I don't believe in abortion.
I don't believe in it, but that is up to each individual, not the state or the government.
I'm walking along a disused railway line that runs alongside the old steel mills here. The track timbers are rotted now, and the rail itself, probably forged in this very plant here, is rusting. Donald Trump won this county by a landslide against Joe Biden in 2020. And again, he has rural Pennsylvania under his belt. For Kamala Harris to win, she has to hold on to the big cities and make ground, crucially, in the suburbs. And that is where the battle for Pennsylvania, this critical swing state, is now being fought.
Well, this is one of our regular work days that we've been having since the campaign started. Today we're doing postcards to Democrats who don't usually vote.
Paula Shrively has been organizing in Somerset County for years. Now she runs the local Democrats here. Of a generation that's seen her state and her country reshaped. Pennsylvania hadn't backed a Republican for nearly three decades when it swung to Trump in 2016. Now she knows how close it is again.
If we could do 2% this year, we'd win. We wouldn't win here. We will never win here when it's 79%, 20% or whatever. We're never going to win here. But what we can do is help win statewide.
Can I leave you just a little thing with the PAWs?
Street by street, door to door, they're out. And Pennsylvania is being fought to the last zero of every zip code.
So every door that I knock on, I know that that is making a dent. It's making a difference.
It's a day off for petrol station pump fixer Bridget Jackson, who says she was compelled to the doorsteps to stop Donald Trump.
As the mother of two daughters, it's incredibly important that they have the right to choose what to do with their own bodies for the rest of their lives.
Back at the riverside with the former steel worker Wayne, he says he'll be watching tonight's debate too. And then an answer that seems to resonate in this part of rural Pennsylvania. Can he be persuaded by the other side?
The Democrats at one time was for the working man. It's not that way anymore.
Why is that?
Why? This socialist stuff. I mean, look at California. Just too much leniency. New York. I mean, why would anybody want to live in New York?
That report was from the BBC's Tom Bateman. The US network ABC is the host of tonight's debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. It'll have two moderators, no live audience at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and it's expected to last 90 minutes. Earlier, I spoke to Molly Ball, senior political correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and host of a podcast called Red, White and Who. I began by asking her if this debate could change the course of the election.
Absolutely. I think it most likely will, given that this is an election that's currently pretty much tied according to all the polls. And so both candidates have an interest in trying to break out of that dynamic, trying to give something to those undecided voters that will secure their votes, lock down their support. Someone has to win this election, and I think there's a very good chance that this debate will be determinative, particularly for Kamala Harris, who is still a bit of an unknown quantity to a lot of voters who still see her as, you know, a new entrant, a new arrival in this campaign and want to know more about her.
So how could either candidate make that crucial breakthrough from the 50-50 deadlock?
Well, that's up to them. And if I were any good at that, I'd probably be advising candidates instead. But look, sometimes the candidates come in with a canned zinger that they hope to land. They've both been practicing. Trump doesn't like to admit that he practices, so he claims that these are just a series of conversations he's having with his advisors. She has been doing a much more traditional rehearsal where she has a stand-in for Donald Trump, who's even dressed like him and imitating his mannerisms, so she can actually plan the scenario that she expects to confront. And so it's about, you know, both how the candidates are able to come across, trying to appear presidential, trying to appear serious and ready to go into that difficult job, and also the insults and attacks that they hope to land to change the perception of their opponents. Most Americans have a pretty good idea of who Donald Trump is and how they feel about him. He has now participated in more presidential debates than any candidate in American history. But both of these candidates are trying to make the argument that they represent the future in a country that's quite dissatisfied, that's quite unhappy with the course of things at the moment.
It's pretty intense, the preparation, isn't it? The candidates are generally holed up, hidden away in hotels, hours and hours of practice. But is getting it right really more of a science than an art?
I don't think so. I think it really is an art because, you know, anyone who has participated in debates will tell you, you have to be able to think on your feet, and it's not mechanical, right? It's not about, I don't think an AI is going to tell you, well, this is what you should say at this particular moment. It's about that creativity to be able to take the question in a direction that perhaps is unexpected or frames it in a new and unexpected way. If the candidates are just repeating their same tired talking points over and over, I don't think that the audience is going to be very receptive to that. People want to hear something new. People want to be shaken out of their preconceptions and want to learn something new from this confrontation, which may be the only one that we're going to have between these two candidates.
And the format, microphones off when the other person is speaking, no audience. Does that make it better or not?
Well, I quite enjoyed the last debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump because it was so sort of clean and orderly. You could really hear the candidates trying to get their points across. Now, of course, Biden memorably tanked in that debate, and most of the attention was on that. But, you know, when there's an audience, it often overwhelms the candidates speaking. They tend to play to the audience and try to get those cheers or jeers, and it's harder to hear and understand the points that they're making. So, you know, there was some arguing between the candidates about the microphones being off or on. They will be off when the candidates aren't speaking, which means that they won't be able to interrupt each other or speak out of turn. I tend to think that is less consequential. And what's most important is just what they're going to say.
And the polls suggest Donald Trump finally would do well to stick to a discussion of the policies, but he doesn't tend to do what he's told.
He doesn't. And that particular piece of advice, it feels like Groundhog Day. I've been hearing senior Republicans wish that Trump would be disciplined and talk about policy for going on 10 years now. And Trump simply doesn't believe that. He thinks it's boring and he thinks that he wins when he fights. If you think back to those early debates in 2015, where he was the only non-politician on stage with all of those extremely well-credentialed Republicans, and that was really the way he made his mark and got noticed and became a contender in this process, was through the debate performance where he didn't follow the rules. He insulted and interrupted and attacked everybody. And he really thinks that is the way that he wins. So I would be quite surprised if we see a very different Donald Trump than we've come to expect on the stage tonight.
Molly Ball, senior political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. This is the BBC World Service and NewsHour. Coming up, the benefits of using drones to deliver medical supplies to remote parts of Africa.
Most of the areas we serve, they have challenges like floods. So whenever it floods, it's very hard to get to the health facilities. And also we have the other challenge of the poor road networks. So that's where the drone comes in, because it can be able to bypass all those challenges.
The headlines: Kamala Harris has accused Donald Trump of having a real problem with the truth ahead of the televised debate between the two presidential candidates. Western nations have imposed new sanctions on Iran for supplying Russia with ballistic missiles to use against Ukraine. And 26 people are confirmed dead, dozens more missing, after a boat carrying migrants capsized off the coast of Senegal. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. A SpaceX rocket has blasted off from Florida in the US on a mission that should see the first spacewalk by non-professional astronauts. Polaris Dawn is aiming also to travel deeper into space than any crewed mission in more than half a century. The four-member team is led by the American billionaire entrepreneur Jared Isaacman.
Four, three, two.
That was the moment of takeoff. Susan Kilrain is watching events on this SpaceX mission with interest. She's a former NASA astronaut and is the youngest person ever to have piloted a space shuttle. I talked to her earlier.
I think the Polaris launch is huge. I mean, the launch itself is relatively standard, but there are so many new things that they're doing on this mission that SpaceX has never done, and NASA hasn't done for a long time. For instance, they're going three times the altitude of the space station, and that hasn't happened since we went to the moon. They're going to do the very first commercial spacewalk, which, you know, is extremely risky. There'll be in new spacesuits for the spacewalk. This is a mission that has a lot of added risk to it. And so it'll be exciting to watch over the next few days.
So some big scientific milestones potentially here, but the people on board are not actually scientists. Does that matter?
You know, they have been training for 2.5 years, I believe, on this mission. So no, they're not technically scientists. There is an Air Force pilot on board, and Jared Isaacman's been into space before. The other two are rookies, but they have worked for SpaceX for quite some time. And so I'm pretty sure they're prepared for the mission. They understand the risks, and hopefully all will go well and we'll learn a lot from it.
Are the risks higher, or not necessarily, because it's a private space mission as opposed to having the weight of NASA behind it?
It's hard to say because I don't know enough about it, but my feeling is SpaceX doesn't do things without putting all of their science into it. So I feel like they've done the research, they've done the testing. Everything that's going into space has been tested in a vacuum, just like space. The astronauts have been trained to know exactly what they're going to experience. Of course, there can be unknowns, and I think that could happen with NASA as well. But there is some people that would say test pilots and such are more ready to handle unknowns in spacecraft, and NASA trains more to the unknowns, perhaps. But if everything goes well, I think they're fully qualified.
Is there anything wrong with market economics being part of space missions? I mean, it's going to be the way of the future, surely, that rich people can buy their way into space rather than study their way into it.
You know, I guess one could argue, what's the point? Just, you know, for a bunch of rich people to go to space. But really, only one rich person is on this mission, and he bought the way of everybody else on the mission. But as long as there are benefits for people here on Earth, which there are, and also perhaps benefits on future space flights further into space, which is kind of the whole reason this is being done, then I think it's a win-win for everybody.
It's certainly keeping the big bills from taxpayers. That'll be a plus for some.
That's a huge plus.
That was former NASA astronaut Susan Kilrain. The international human rights charity Global Witness says it's documented 196 killings during last year of people who were trying to stop the destruction of natural environments around the world. They range from those who are trying to protect indigenous communities to those trying to stop mining projects or the advance of mass monoculture into ancient forest. I've been speaking to Laura Furones, who's a senior advisor to Global Witness and lead author of their report.
To give you a sense of who these people might be, I mean, we're talking about people like a Colombian small-scale farmer trying to get on with their daily lives and having this sort of small plot of land encroached by corporate interests. We're also talking about activists in the Philippines trying to fend off destructions of the lands to make way for a large-scale airport or other kinds of infrastructure. We're also talking about indigenous peoples in the Amazon trying to protect their forests from destruction.
Latin America seems to be a center of these kind of killings, tragically, and Colombia especially. Why there?
Yeah, that's a really hard reality that we have to face, because year in and year out, Latin America emerges as the most dangerous region for defenders. And as you rightly say, Colombia in particular reports appalling figures every year. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. But the key ones is that civil society and social movements and indigenous peoples and local communities are really powerful in Latin America. So they're really able to make their voices heard, and they're being attacked for doing so. But also, that doesn't mean in any way that being a defender in regions like Asia or Africa is any safer.
And how carefully researched is your data? Can you establish direct links in all these cases between the murder of an individual and specific, say, corporate interests?
So this is a really hard thing to do, and it speaks to a number of things. It speaks to the difficulty in accessing information, but it also speaks to the prevalence of impunity. You know, in 2023, for instance, out of 196 cases, we were able to identify mining as the sector linked to the largest amount of cases, and that was 25 all in all. But often we just don't know enough to make those direct links, which of course doesn't mean that they don't exist.
And presumably where there are killings, there are also attacks, injuries, trying to scare people off.
Absolutely. I mean, murders are the most brutal form of attacks. But we, you know, our report also features a number of cases from around the world of defenders who are luckily very much alive, but, you know, are subject to all sorts of non-lethal attacks, you know, including criminalization, which is on the rise globally, but also threats and harassment and sexual violence. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Who do you hope your report will influence most?
Well, we're hoping that the report will really strike a chord with governments around the world whose responsibility it is to protect land environmental defenders and to make sure that they provide safe operating environments for them, you know, so they can just do their works without fearing for their lives. And we're also hoping that corporate big enterprises will do the right thing, which is exercise due diligence and therefore identify, you know, way before they come to any land to establish their extractive projects, just establish what risks there are, you know, and talk to the communities there, you know, talk to them about what the risks might be and make right decisions about their operations that go beyond just profit and take into account possible human rights violations.
Where politicians are made aware of the problem, they tend to say the right things. That's different from action. The Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, pledges to crack down on violence against environmental defenders, and yet his country is the worst in case.
That's absolutely right. And I think we've all heard some very encouraging words from the Colombian government. And actually, they've also taken some decisive steps, including, for instance, the ratification of the Escazú Agreement, which is a crucial piece of legislation because it relates to accessing information and accessing justice for defenders, which is absolutely essential. But as you say, that sadly is not yet being reflected in reality. And with Colombia particularly hosting Biodiversity COP in just over a month, we do hope that the Colombian government is ready to put their money where their words are and, you know, making sure that all these commitments that we're hearing translated into reality and into violence decreasing.
Laura Furones, senior advisor to Global Witness in Madrid, BBC World Service. Welcome back to NewsHour. In Kenya, in East Africa, fleets of high-tech drones are delivering HIV drugs and testing kits to rural areas. It's part of an innovative project funded by the Elton John AIDS Foundation to tackle a rise in new HIV infections. Myra Anubi went to Western Kenya to see it in action.
Launching kit 977 in 3, 2, 1...
From a launch pad just outside the city of Kisumu, a fixed-wing drone is fired into the sky carrying a cargo of HIV drugs and testing kits. Flying at speeds of up to 100 kilometers per hour, they can deliver the drugs to remote areas quickly and accurately. Sharon Omoja is in charge of flight operations for the drone delivery company, Zipline.
Most of the areas we serve, they have challenges like floods. So whenever it floods, it's very hard to get to the health facilities. And also we have the other challenge of the poor road networks. So that's where the drone comes in, because it can be able to bypass all those challenges.
To find out where a lot of these drones are taking their packages, I took a ride on some bumpy roads to a rural part of the country. The project is targeting young people, so the drones are taking HIV supplies to places where they're likely to go, such as sports events.
So we've made it to a village called Nyakoko, and as you can hear, it's buzzing everywhere. It's an open field. There's a football tournament with girls and young boys playing. But over to my right is a white tent, and this is a mobile health clinic.
We are having an outreach activity. We are targeting adolescents and youths with reproductive health services and HIV services.
This is Joel Abor, one of the nurses. He explained why young people prefer this to a formal healthcare facility.
It could be stigma. Yeah, they feel that I'm going to a facility. Maybe a neighbor will see me. We are in an African society. We've got our cultural beliefs. We've got our religious beliefs. Probably that one could be acting as a barrier to them seeking health services at the facility. So we are running out of trust condoms. We are running out of self-test kits.
When supplies start to run down, Joel can order new ones from Zipline on his phone, and they're delivered in less than an hour.
And our dropping point should be in the field, around where
the
boys
young men are
playing.
There it is.
The drone drops a small parachute with a red box attached. It floats to the ground, and Joel goes over to check he's got what he orders. Zipline estimates that they've reached more than 80,000 young people in the year and a half that the project has been going, and more than 4,000 have now started taking preventative drugs.
Myra Anubi reporting, and you can find out more about the project in this week's edition of People Fixing the World here on the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour here on the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Israel struck a declared safe zone in Gaza today in missile attacks the Hamas-run territory's health ministry said killed at least 19 people, and which the Israeli military said targeted Palestinian militants. Massive craters were made in tented settlements in the sand in Al-Mawazi in the southern Gaza Strip, which Israel had designated a humanitarian zone early on in the war. What happened today prompted condemnation from the region and beyond. Earlier we spoke to a journalist in Gaza, he's also a translator, Akram Al-Sarati. He sent us this audio note describing what he saw at the scene, because the line wasn't stable enough for a full conversation.
I saw two big holes. One of them is as big as 40 meters long. People were gathering around the two big holes. Some other people were busy by their shattered tents, collecting whatever stuff they can. The tents that were erected on top of the soil in that area ended up buried with the people inside them. I saw many people trying to find their dears under the sand, and people were telling the story of two people who were getting married and ended up being buried in the tent that they got married at. They were telling the story of the children. Their toes were just thrown among the other things that were shattered because of the explosion. And at the very same time, there were some other people who were trying to erect their tents and live in that area again.
An eyewitness report. We've asked the Israeli Defense Forces for an interview on what happened. They were not available. They did send this statement, which we voiced up, in which they insist precision weapons were used.
Despite the extensive measures taken by the IDF to enable the Gazan population to move away from combat zones, including by designating a humanitarian area, the Hamas terrorist organization continues to embed its operatives and military infrastructure in the humanitarian area and systematically use Gazan civilians as a human shield for its terrorist activities.
Shortly before we came on air, I spoke to...
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution...
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mike Thompson. I asked him about that Israeli airstrike on Al-Mawazi first.
It looks like there are at least 19 people dead from this strike, and it could be more than that because some people are said to be missing. So, and it's in a very crowded set of tents, about 200 tents that lie in the Gazan coast from the southern city of Khan Yunis. And it's amazing, really, that it isn't more than that, because these tents offer no protection whatsoever to such a fire. And the craters that were created by these missiles was huge. I mean, at least 9 metres or if not more apart across.
And the Israeli military said it was targeting Hamas members. Has it said if it killed any?
It has, yes. It said that it's managed to kill three senior, as it called it, terrorists from Hamas, as well as possibly some others as well. And it says, by the way, that we talked about the loss of life, and it said these attacks were carried out with a lot of extensive intelligence, with aerial surveillance, and with precision munition. Although, as I was saying just now, precision munition, if it's that powerful to make the sort of huge craters in the ground, you wonder, you know, how precision can it actually have been when you're dealing with tents that offer no protection to people.
Also today, we had an IDF report on the killing of an American Turkish activist at a protest in the occupied West Bank last week. What did the report say?
This young woman was Ayşenur Ezgi Eydi. She was at a demonstration against increasing settlements in the West Bank that was taking place near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. And Israeli security forces tried to stop this protest. And they claim that they were having rocks hurled at them and that they shot, trying to hit the instigator behind the rock at stone-throwing attacks. And yet it was Ayşenur who was the person who was hit and killed. They've now admitted that it was, they believe, highly likely to have been an Israeli bullet that killed her, but said it was also highly likely that it was completely unintentional.
The American Secretary of State has been particularly outspoken on this subject today. He was speaking at a news conference here in London. This is what he had to say.
No one should be shot and killed for attending a protest. No one should have to put their life at risk just for freely expressing their views. In our judgment, Israeli security forces need to make some fundamental changes in the way that they operate in the West Bank, including changes to their rules of engagement.
It isn't every day that a senior member of the American government is that critical of the Israeli security forces, is it?
It isn't, and indeed he went even further and said later that he wanted to see fundamental changes to how the Israeli army operates in the occupied West Bank. But this has been said before. If you remember, in May 2022, the Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who's also a US citizen, she was killed after being shot. And when she was covering an Israeli military operation in Jenin, and it took a year for the Israeli military to concede that, yes, it was an Israeli bullet, or very probably that had killed her. At least this has happened a lot sooner than that.
Is a formal independent investigation expected into this?
At least what Antony Blinken has called for, a criminal investigation, but there's going to be a lot more extensive inquiry than has been revealed up to now. What we've heard today has just been a preliminary conclusion. There's going to be a much deeper investigation, and Mr. Blinken has said he and the State Department will be keeping a very close eye on that.
That was the BBC's correspondent in Jerusalem, Mike Thompson. Returning now to tonight's upcoming US presidential TV debate and the campaign generally, Generation Z, or the older section of it, because Gen Z people are aged 12 to 27, is emerging as a key voter bloc. There are around 40 million of them eligible to vote in November, nearly one-fifth, therefore, of the American electorate. According to recent reports, they're feeling the pinch of inflation particularly. That's led to a surge of Gen Z candidates in local elections. Our reporter Natalie Jimenez met two young men who are candidates in upcoming elections in their states, Democrat Gabriel Sanchez from Georgia and Wyatt Gable, a Republican from North Carolina.
Hey there, sir. How are you doing today?
The morning after his night shift, Sanchez is already out knocking on doors. Meanwhile, Gable's fundraising efforts are in full swing.
Well, I appreciate everything you've been able to give, and thank you all.
For Sanchez, it's the experience of being young in this economy that's ultimately driving him.
We can't afford a home. We don't know if we're ever going to be able to buy a home. We can't afford the basic necessities that we need. We're working, you know, our tails off, and we're not seeing any rewards for it.
Gable believes it's his generation's unifying issue.
I definitely think my generation feels it, especially now this year, seeing as how bad inflation is and interest rates are and all those things are skyrocketing. That's going to be the biggest thing on people's minds.
So to know more, I put out a call to Gen Zers from around the country to send me voice notes about how they're feeling. And here's what Russ, Isabella, and Rosha had to say.
It is virtually impossible for somebody as a Gen Z person to survive in this economy. You are working all the time to pay off your student loan debt. And I will literally not be paying this stuff off until 2039.
It kind of is scary as someone who's just entering the workforce, kind of not knowing where what your future holds.
We don't have the opportunity to make mistakes anymore. It's just bills on top of bills that just constantly keep coming after us. I just don't feel like that's a way to live. We cannot possibly fathom a candidate not addressing the economic crisis right now.
You know, we're about to experience the greatest wealth transfer in history. There's going to be some Gen Z and millennials who inherit homes from their boomer parents. There'll be some that don't. And like that gap is going to be really important to pay attention to.
Some new Gen Z voters. Now to someone just above that age group as an undecided voter from Philadelphia, Rohan Vijayan, who is 29, is potential gold dust to both big US political parties. What's more, he says tonight's TV debate could be the thing that swings it for him. I spoke to Rohan earlier. I asked him whether he was aware quite how much his vote counted.
Oh, abundantly aware. So, you know, at the end of the day, I've lived in several states in this country, in Illinois, in Maryland, which were heavily Democratic states, almost no point in voting, though I did vote in both those elections. This is my first in a absolute swing state where I think the election will be decided. And frankly, I've never been more excited to vote. I mean, wish it was different candidates, but I think this is going to be the most influential election that I will ever vote for. So very excited to participate in that.
It does sound as if the debate could be a bit of a game changer for you, though.
It could. I think more than anything else is a game changer for me when it regards to Kamala. I think I understand who Trump is. He's been around for a while. He's been through probably 6, 7, 8 debates already. So I get an idea of who he is, and I'd be shocked if he changes his personality at this debate. What I'm really looking for is discover who Kamala really is. That's something that's a big question mark to me right now. And to determine whether she's able to, you know, eloquently and firmly sort of take command of the stage, attack Trump, but not too deeply, and really define her policies for me. That's what I'm looking for. So it's a better debate, perhaps, to see who she is rather than Trump, who I already kind of know who is.
And what policies are you drawn to as a voter? What do you want to see change?
So more than anything else, I would say that the economy, first and foremost, number one issue. I think there's not too much clear guidance. I think that's number one. Number two, I would say, is immigration. I think that's one that I struggle with both parties. I think there are cons on both sides. I think the Republicans are a little, I think they have the right idea of restricting legal immigration. But I think the sentiments that are created from that, the anti-immigration sentiments from the extremists on that side, was a little too harsh. But I also disagree with the, especially Kamala. She was in charge of the border for several years, and she doesn't have a clear strategy either. So those are the two issues. And I don't have clarity really on where each candidate stands firmly on those and whether they're going to be able to effectively solve these issues.
But the exchange between the two main candidates tonight is pretty important for you. And you've said that you want to see Harris put Trump down, but in a polite way. What do you mean?
So what I mean by that is that she does have a prosecutorial background. She was a prosecutor out in California. And so, you know, I want to see her hold him accountable. It's something that is very difficult to do with Trump because he has an incredible knack to redirect and just, you know, disorient people into an unbelievable amount of misinformation. So I want to see her, you know, factually hold him accountable for things he said, things he's done, flip-flopping even on something like abortion recently. I know he's flip-flopped a couple of times on that. But I don't want it to devolve into personal attacks. I don't want it to devolve into a shouting match, which I know they do have the mics muted when someone's not speaking, so hopefully that won't occur. But I want to see her become a prosecutor against him, but also not make that the whole crux of the debate.
Enjoy the debate, Rohan. Have you got the popcorn ready?
I have the popcorn ready. I have a beer on my hand, ready to watch the whole thing.
Rohan Vijayan there, an undecided voter from Philadelphia. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Around 600,000 people have attended a mass in East Timor, presided over by Pope Francis, as part of his 12-day tour of the Asia-Pacific region. The event, held in searing heat on the outskirts of the capital, Dili, was one of the biggest masses of the papacy, with the 87-year-old receiving a rapturous welcome from the huge crowd. The open-air congregation for the Mass represented, in fact, nearly half of East Timor's population. Alongside that enthusiasm for the Pope's visit, there was some criticism over the cost of hosting the trip, as well as a dispute over the land that the actual Mass was held on. Just over 2 weeks ago, the Taliban's supreme leader passed a new morality law. The more than 100-page-long document prescribes a code of conduct for Afghan citizens and further increases already severe restrictions on women, that their faces and bodies must be fully covered and even that their voices must not be heard in public places. Already, secondary and higher education is banned for girls and women, and they aren't allowed to work except in a very few sectors. The BBC has had rare access to women and girls in Afghanistan reacting to the new law. From Kabul, Yogita Limai reports.
On previous visits, we've met with a psychologist who's talked to us about what she calls a pandemic of suicidal thoughts among Afghan women because of the restrictions on them. We've come back to meet her again. It's too risky for us to go to where she lives, so we're meeting in a separate, discreet location to find out what she's experienced since the new law was passed.
I'm experiencing one of the worst stress ever. My stomach has started so much issue. I've started having sleep issues. Even if they don't come to you and tell you that you have to cover your face, you don't have to like laugh or talk, but when they just go beside you, you just feel like shock. You feel like that your heartbeat gets up high. So it's a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of hopelessness.
You're a psychologist. You've been communicating with lots of people who talk to you about their mental health problems. But especially since the new law was passed, what are people telling you about what their state of mind is like?
Actually, most often when I talk to friends, to my students, to colleagues, there is no hope. And it's better to die than to live in this situation. These are societal thoughts. It's getting a lot and a lot day by day.
Every time these incremental restrictions on women have been announced in Afghanistan, in the past, what we have seen is small groups of women marching on the streets, shouting slogans, asking for the right to study and the right to work. This time around, though, we have seen no demonstrations of those sort. We know the Taliban has clamped down on them. We've come to meet a woman who used to be a part of those protests. She has to move houses every few weeks for her safety. Because of the risks she's facing, it's taken quite a bit of time to figure out the logistics to try and even meet her safely. She asked for her voice to be changed so she wouldn't be identified.
I thought it was my duty to join the women who were protesting for our rights. The Taliban beat me and dragged me into a vehicle saying, "Why are you acting against us? This is an Islamic system." They took me to a dark, frightening place and insulted me with terrible words. We were treated like animals, and that's why we couldn't continue protesting. After being released from detention, we weren't the same people we were before.
She broke down as she spoke. Now, Afghan women have been showing their dissent by posting videos of themselves online, singing songs criticizing the Taliban's actions. I've come to the Taliban government's media center. I'm here to meet the Taliban government's deputy spokesman, Hamdullah Fitrat, and I'm going to ask him about the new law.
There are people in your own country, there are even people who are working for your government who say that your interpretation of the Sharia is wrong, that the Sharia does not deny women basic rights. How can you justify a law that doesn't allow their voices to be heard in public?
The laws that have been introduced have been approved by the Supreme Leader in accordance with Islamic Sharia. Any religious scholar can check their references.
Most of the girls and women we've spoken to in your country say they are prepared to wear whatever it is that your government prescribes as long as you allow them to study. And because they're not being allowed to do that, they're being driven to the point of depression, even suicidal thoughts. Isn't it your responsibility as a government to listen to those voices and act on it?
Absolutely. Our sisters' education is an important issue. We are trying to resolve this, which is the demand of a lot of our sisters. We have mentioned it several times in the past too, that our leadership is working on it. A solution will be found.
It's been 3 years now since girls were locked out of schools. Do you really expect people to believe that you are committed to actually doing it?
We are awaiting the decision of our leadership.
Inshallah.
It's been evident for a long time that there are divisions within the Taliban on the issue of women's education. And while for most women and teenage girls that means that they're blocked from getting an education, from college, from work of any sort, during our visits to this country, we
have often heard that there are pockets where there are government-run efforts to include women specifically in the public health sector. And now we've been given exclusive access to something that usually stays running behind the scenes. I'm at a training course for midwives that's run by the Taliban Public Health Department. And all of the women in front of me, there are about a dozen of them. All of them are young women who appear to be in their 20s. My family feels proud of the work that I do. It gives me positive energy. I'm happy to be able to serve the people of my country. 27-year-old Safiya told us. What I'm seeing in front of me, this is not likely to bring hope for a majority of women and teenage girls, but it is perhaps evidence that there are people within the Taliban government who are trying to facilitate and enable the exceptions to the stringent laws where it's possible.
Yogita Limai reporting from Afghanistan. Thank you for listening to this edition of NewsHour. Enjoy what's left of your day. Goodbye for now.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.